It's November 15th, 2006. I'm Jordan Goffin interviewing Chris Mullins.
Chris Mullin, former Special Collections librarian, being interviewed by a current Special Collections librarian, Jordan Goffin. I arrived here in November of 1969, making, I believe, $7,400 as a cataloger. In those days, we had a bunch of catalogers. I'm looking now at the 1970 phone book, and which will make it convenient. At that point, which would, of course, have been in early 1970, about a year after I got here, Adelaine Midget had taken over from Mary DeLand as the head of cataloging. I never even worked with Mrs. DeLand because they knew that she was retiring at the end of the year, and I got there in November. Cataloging in those days was very different from the way it is today, because most cataloging had to be done originally. The National Union Catalog existed, but of course it was way behind since it was published in paper. And a lot of materials never got into the National Union Catalog for years and years. Only the things cataloged by LC got in, and there was no cataloging in publication either. So unless you wanted to wait around for a long time, maybe years, why there was a tendency to catalog things now. It was possible to order computer-produced cards, and we had just started doing that from a company in Oregon before I arrived. The backlog had gotten really pretty overwhelming when I arrived. It was like 20 or 30,000 volumes, I think. And our code from the company that was selling the cards was D-U-M-M, so we referred to... No, I'm sorry, D-U-U-M. So we referred to them as dumb cards, naturally enough. And at that point, there were complaints that they didn't do things like... printing all subject headings in red, for example. Mm-hmm. In the card catalog, all subject headings were in red, authors and titles were typed at the top of the card in black. So we solved that problem by ordering them without anything typed, and we just typed the tracings on ourselves. That wasn't as much extra work as you might think, because we only had dumb cards for about half the things we got. Mm-hmm. At that point, basically, as I say, except for that, there was no copy cataloging. And in those days, the attitude was that even if you had copy, it really ought to be looked at by a professional librarian to see what it was like. And I must say, after spending 18 years as a cataloger, I can see the advantages to that, because LC does make mistakes, especially when cataloging is new. These days, it's not as big a problem, because if there are any overwhelming major mistakes, why somebody will catch them and will fix them on the master record. And then when the master record is downloaded again, why, it'll be right for everybody in the country. But that wasn't the case in the old days. Nobody was checking it again except all the thousands of individual catalogers who were checking it. There were also the tens of thousands or more of other catalogers who weren't checking it at all. So if you wanted your catalog to reflect the truth, it probably did make sense to have somebody with a master's degree in librarianship actually looking at everything. For the things that we did ourselves, in those days, there were, of course, no self-correcting typewriters, and correction fluid and typing being what it is, and most of us being cruddy typists anyway, why we normally hand-wrote our cataloging out, and it was then turned over to the typists. We had several typists in the department to go along with several catalogers. The typists would put those red subject headings at the top of the dumb cards, and they would also put the red subject headings at the top of the master cards that they got from the Xerox machine. We did not type all the cards by hand. There was one Xerox machine in the library. It was a Xerox 750, which is the same model that is in the Smithsonian Institution now, the original commercial Xerox machine. And we continued using that until, I believe, we were still using our machine for the purpose of doing cards. We weren't using it for anything else by that time. When I arrived, I think it may have been the only copier in the library, although if so, there were other coin-op copiers added fairly soon. But we kept using that old machine for cards until after there was one just like it in the Smithsonian. Would copy the cards onto a sheet. Sometimes there'd be five cards in a set, sometimes there'd be six cards in a set. The minimum would be three cards, a shelf card, the normal minimum would be an author card, a title card, and a shelf list card. If it's nonfiction, there might conceivably be a title main entry, but in that case there'd be at least one subject heading. There were a lot less subject headings in those days than there are today. There was a tendency on the part of all catalogers, because of the nature of the workflow, if nothing else, to try and keep cards down to where there weren't any card twos or card threes if you could get away from it. There's a lot more in an average catalog record today than there was in the year 1970. This was not, it's not necessarily true to say that there's more in a new catalog record today than there always was. There was a time back around 100 years ago now, in the first decade of the 20th century, when there were many cards that many catalog records produced that had extensive contents, notes, and analytics. And if you look in the old pre-1956 NUC, you can see some of them. They were as detailed as cards are today, or as cataloging is today. We would... Once the cards were out of the machine, they'd get the headings typed on them, and then we got to alphabetize them using Do you think people know, Jordan, about what an alphabetizer is today? I'd probably better explain it to them.
I kind of doubt, yeah.
Okay. Well, an alphabetizer, we might even still have one or two around the library in the basement, I don't know, is a device with about 26 little slots that you slip cards into. The ones for set up for libraries were labeled A to Z, and then were also set up with 00 through 900 at the top of the alphabetizer, because of course we, like many other libraries, were a Dewey Decimal Library. Unlike a lot of them, we still are. Alphabetizing or organizing the shelf cards was fairly simple, and then everything else got organized into one alphabet, and this would be some hundreds of cards in a week, obviously, because you're putting through, I don't know, 100 or more books a week. I don't really remember what the catalog department was turning out. I think probably, if anyone wants to research this, that there's some stuff back in archives that would allow you to do that for this time period. There were new book printed lists that I believe were still being made up in that time period. The final step was the actual filing of the cards into the catalog. I was never very good at that, but I had to file anyway, as did the other catalogers. As a result of this, the catalogers in those days really did have a much better sense of what was in the card catalog and of how to use the card catalog than did any of the reference librarians. My impression is that reference librarians at that point typically, on average, knew about as much about actually using a card catalog as the people who had just had in high school a good course in it. We knew a lot more. There were a lot of things you could do with a card catalog. Some of them you can't do with an online catalog, at least not nearly as conveniently. One minor example, everybody knows that McDonald might be M.A.C. Donald or M.C. Donald, but nobody really is sure in a particular case which it is. Well, with cards, we just interfiled them. And we interfiled them all in this library as though it was M.A.C. And then there would be a cross-reference card, MCC MAC. And if anybody found the cross-reference card, they'd understand it. And if they didn't find the cross-reference card but looked at the drawers, there'd be drawers that began with Mac, and they'd figure it out, probably. Mm-hmm. At least we like to think that they did. That's just one example. There were a lot of things that we did that are not done today. We maintained contents books for series. There were some big series, really big series with hundreds of volumes in them, going on that did not seem worth listing a separate card for every volume in the catalog, or maybe they figured you that you would want to look at the catalog, at the list of the series, and because this was a major series. I'm not really sure how these came about, because this is one of those things that had been in effect long before I arrived in this library. These series were listed in a book. We would just pull out the page from the three-hole punch notebook and type the next one in. We tended to do this quite a lot for series that were really big. The other thing that we did with series, rather than list a separate card for each item in the series, if it was an analyzed series where you everything is cataloged under a uniform call number, as we still have some of today, then you would just have cards in the catalog, and one card would have five or six entries on it. For the series cards. And then, of course, in addition to that, there would be a full set of entries for the individual item, an author card, a title card, subject cards, and so on. But if you looked it up by the series, you would find it this way. None of this sort of stuff is necessary these days, but I think it's worth talking about for the benefit of whoever will be listening, because people these days don't know how a library used to operate, and I think it's useful to, if this tape of mine is useful at all, it's useful to try to show people what things were like and how they changed. We did, even then, attempt to be up to date. When I arrived, we were using a homegrown acquisitions system that ran on the campus mainframe, which I think was a PDP-11 that is of about as powerful as a modern cell phone. Maybe not quite. But it was adequate for running an acquisitions program with, I think, one line of 80 characters per item. This was all input, of course, with punch cards. In those days, there were no online catalogs, though.
How did the, if I can interrupt, how did the change over to the online catalog here take place? What prompted it? What was the
Well, what prompted the change to online catalogs every place was the same two things that prompted the change in a lot of libraries from Dewey to the Library of Congress system. A, it was the modern new thing to do, and B, people figured it would save money. In the case of changing over to the Library of Congress system, that was probably not justified, actually. But in the case of an online catalog, it really was. It not only is a modern public access catalog the obvious way to go, but you really can do a bunch of things with that that you couldn't do with an online catalog, or with a card catalog, too. I mentioned a couple of things that you can do with a card catalog, but there's a lot of things you can do with an online catalog, of which maybe the most important is keyword searching. As of 1981, I believe, started cataloging. Is that right? That doesn't sound like it can be right. No, it can't be 1981. It must be a little later than that. We started with the cataloging with the Western Library Network. It would be possible to check that, and I maybe should have looked that up to verify it. The Western Library Network has now been merged into the OCLC network, but it was at the time one of the main competitors of OCLC. It started out as the Washington Library Network, and after it left Washington State, it became the Western Library Network, and covered Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. Not all the libraries, but most of the bigger libraries in those four, and Alaska, most of the bigger libraries in those five states. And its selling point, they were, of course, delighted to have anybody else sign up who wanted to, but nobody else much did, which is one reason that they eventually merged. The selling point of Willen, WLN, Washington or Western Library Network, the selling point of Willen was that they actually had human beings looking at the records we input and attempting to dedupe, something which, as any cataloging students who ever listen to this will realize, OCLC has never really been good at, even now. We got terminals for use with Willen in the early 80s. In those days, they were dumb terminals that were just connected by, I think originally, phone lines to the one phone line per terminal, probably, to the main Willen headquarters in Western Washington. And it was at that point that we had to start actually coding and typing, cataloging. Notice that this didn't happen until I'd been doing the other with the cards for 10 years. Perhaps more than 10 years. I can't remember. The year 1981 comes to mind, which would be 12 years. But I'm not certain of that year. Before then, we had actually had a whole revolution in cataloging. We got rid of the dumb cards, and we started getting proof slips from the Library of Congress. LC used to, back in the days when they were still printing cards that they sent out to people's catalogs, they, for each card, they printed on thinner paper a proof slip. And you could subscribe to all the proof slips, or all the English language proof slips, or all the proof slips. Maybe at some point in there they went to all the proof slips in certain languages. For a long time, we subscribed to all the proof slips. We got hundreds of thousands of proof slips in this building. And when I left, I was still using some of the leftovers for scratch. The exciting thing about the proof slips was that we had to file them. A couple of hundred thousand of them a year. Everything that LC cataloged, we threw away all the Asian language stuff, and we threw away. I think we even threw away the Cyrillic. I think we threw away all the non-Roman stuff just automatically, if we were buying it. But the Roman language stuff, you couldn't tell what you were going to get. We were an academic library. And so on the basis that you couldn't tell what you were going to get, we filed them, alphabetical order by title. And we all had to spend lots and lots of time alphabetizing those, a lot more than we ever had to spend alphabetizing the cards. But it saved money. It really did, because you had the things in hand. You didn't have to find them. You didn't, because they were alphabetized by title, you didn't have to worry about how LC was actually going to catalog this. In those days, if you were going to order things from LC, you basically had to order them by main entry. And as any catalogers hearing this will appreciate, even these days, determining the main entry is kind of a crapshoot. But if you have everything organized by title, you can probably find it. So we were doing that for years before, and I think even for a little while after we went on the Western Library Network. Then we stayed on Willen for close to 15 years before we actually got an online catalog, and that was not because we didn't want an online catalog. It was because we never got the money for it. Willen also had a much more a sophisticated acquisition system, and we bought into that shortly after we bought into their cataloging system. The cataloging system was, of course, in many ways like OCLC is today. You find the record online, and you've got this huge database to search from, and you can search this huge database anyway, including keywords. Mm-hmm. And so if there's a record out there, you can probably find it. Mm-hmm. If there are multiple records out there, which was not as likely, remember, on the Willen system, why, you can probably pick the right one. And the biggest difference between the way that that was done then and the way that OCLC cataloging is done now was that Willen, instead of using the numeric keys for author, title, the three-digit 500 for subject headings, and so on, they had three-letter codes, which was supposed to be easier to work with, and it was, except that Willen was the only people in the world who were using it. It was easier to work with. I never did. I stopped cataloging at about the time that just before we the changeover occurred, a couple of years before the changeover occurred. So I never did learn all the numeric keys. After your cataloging class, Jordan, you know the numeric keys better than I do. He's shaking his head about that, but he really does. We tried several times to get get on an online catalog, but it fell through. It cost a lot of money, and it was one of those things that we had a card catalog. We had a pretty good card catalog, if I do say so myself. The money several times turned out to be used for or needed for something else. In the early 70s, we'd been really short of money because it was at that point that the enrollment on this campus actually dropped. The baby boom was done, and the baby bust was coming along. As a result, there were a couple of years when we literally had no general acquisitions budget for monographs at all. We cut serials considerably, but even after cutting serials, there was no general money to buy monographs. We cataloged during that time. We got completely rid of our backlog. One thing that we got rid of, for example, we'd had, we're talking about the late 70s in here, maybe up to 1980. We had had sitting around for about 40 years WPA, Works Progress Administration project books that were things like bibliographies of various states and so on. And they had just been sitting in back in the storage cage in a succession of buildings, because, of course, we weren't in this building until the mid-70s. We had been just hanging on to these. They had been absolute bottom priority, but we got them cataloged. Finally, in 1995, we got the money for our first ALPAC, and we've been on our second ALPAC now for several years.
So how long did you stay in catalog before moving?
I stayed in cataloging for 18 years, about. I left in 1987.
Okay. And how did you end up coming to Special Collections?
Well, the former Special Collections librarian, Kathy Schaefer, had unfortunately become ill several years earlier. She'd had to quit work for a while. When she returned, it was in a wheelchair, and then she had to leave again, and was never able to return. She died soon thereafter. And for a time, we were without a special collections librarian. We did get one woman come in. Jordan actually has some leftover files from her. Came in for a year, and I am blocking the name. Was it Janice Pacino?
I'm actually not familiar with this.
You've got them in your desk if you haven't moved them down below there.
They might be.
Mm-hmm. We can check this if we wish. Let's see. I think maybe we can check this. Let's see. And another advantage of doing this digitally is that if I take a little break like this, why, we can edit that out real, real easily. Let's see. Let's see here. No, she wasn't listed in here. She might have been in the next volume. No, that's the previous volume, yeah. Oh, gee. Shall we get that? Right, shall we try to get that?
I'll go ahead and pause this. No, go ahead.
Okay. As I was saying, Janice Pacino was for 1 year and on a non-tenure track contract as the Special Collections Librarian. And that was the 85-86 year. And but she left after that year, and I'm not frankly sure exactly why. It was considered that I was getting, after 18 years, I was getting a little burned out on cataloging anyway. When it was suggested that I might want to do cataloging, I jumped at the chance. I might want to leave cataloging. I jumped at the chance to go down to Special Collections. At that point, Kobe Johnson, as of the time I'm speaking, the head of Bibliographic Management Services, came back to the library. After she married Dale Johnson and had kids, she had taken some time off, about 10 years actually, away from cataloging, and she came back first part-time and then full-time to cataloging.
Mentioned downstairs at that point, Special Collections was on the first floor.
Yes, at that point, Special Collections was on level one of the library, two floors below ground, and technical services, as we then called it, was located where Bibliographic Management Services is today. Special Collections remained downstairs until it would have been the year 2004, I believe, 2003, 2004, mm-hmm. I think, when we moved up to level four. You should check that one, because this is one of those things that I obviously ought to know, but I don't have anything there telling me how many years was I up here before I retired.
Okay. So you started in 1985.
I started in 1987 up downstairs in Special Collections, and as Special Collections librarian then, I did pretty much the things I did up to my retirement in 2005. And subsequent to my retirement, when I came back on the post-retirement contract in 2005-2006. Special Collections librarian then as now was responsible for the Montana collection and the state documents collection and books on the state of other books on the state of Montana and the general area. I guess I can say he still, since Jordan is the Special Collections librarian now, he was responsible for the actual locked Special Collections items. I also took it on myself to continue paying attention to the microform collection, because nobody else was really doing that. Mm-hmm. And I sold a few Montana duplicates, and I attempted to be an expert on the campus, too, on the basis that a lot of the things that people are the most interested in are campus related things, and that we need to have one or two people in the library who know about that stuff. Mm-hmm. At that point, Special Collections was all a closed stack area, not only the things in the Special Collections cage, but the regular Montana collection was also kept locked away. That was a circulating closed stacks collection. You found in the catalog something that you were interested in, or you asked us, and we would try to give you additional suggestions, and we got it out for you, and you checked it out and took it home. There were actually two such collections. There was, you can see fossil remnants as I speak in 2006. You can see fossil remnants of this in the stacks on level four, the stacks of the Montana room. Some books had an M at the beginning of the call number for Montana Collection. Others had an S because they were state documents. When we moved upstairs, we merged those two collections. We never merged them when we were downstairs because it frankly seemed like more work than it would be worth. We were real short of space anyway. It was a lot more convenient to move these things. We were just able to move, like, say, everything from 900 to 910, for example. I don't remember exactly what ranges of numbers we used, but something like that. Move the 900 through 910 M collection books and the 900 through 910 S collection books and just merge them on the shelves. Mm-hmm. That went pretty quickly. If you didn't have a third place to move them to but had tried to interfile them, it would have taken weeks and weeks of somebody's time. And all during those weeks and weeks, when they were an open stack collection, it would have been difficult to use them. Mm-hmm. I did get awfully tired of explaining the difference between the M and the S collections, though, during the years when I had to do so. As a special collections librarian, I was, of course, responsible for ordering material for those collections and also ordering material for the special collections. One big order that I put in at the beginning of the time, right after I took over, I discovered that there was about, $25,000, I think, of money sitting around from the Phillips Collection bequest. That produces several thousand dollars a year, and it apparently hadn't been touched for almost 10 years when I took over. I could have bought something really impressive with that money. One thing that occurred to me was getting a set of the original 1814 edition of the Lewis and Clark journals. Mm-hmm. At that time, in the late 80s, I could probably have gotten a set complete with the folding map for around $25,000. These days, that two-volume set with the folding map, which is not in anywhere near all the copies, is in the $150,000 and up range. Mm-hmm. But I concluded that that was one book that people weren't going to look at that much, and that we had serious gaps in our Western history collection. And so instead, I bought the microfilm series, it's the Yale series, the 517 reels, and what is the name of it? We can look that up. You can put that in. You just go downstairs and look in 973 for 517 reels of microfilm, and you can stick that in quicker than we can get it here, because I'm blocking it. To go on with the part you're going to leave in, that series gave us a lot of material that we don't have yet, except in that format. Eventually, that will probably all be available online, but not for a long time, because there's some of it actually that is 20th century. Mm-hmm. There's some of that stuff, a little of it, that I think is probably still in copyright as of 2006. It's not all available yet. We have subsequently got a lot of it in that is of most interest to Montana in hard copy, either by purchase or by gift. and either in reprints or as originals. But there's even some of the Montana stuff, I'm sure, that we don't yet have. And there's a lot of the stuff on the rest of in the rest of the series, because this is, it covers the entire Trans-Mississippi West from the 16th century on up. Buying the entire thing in hard copy, it was totally impossible. Wouldn't make any sense anyway, because we've got other priorities for our money. But by spending $20,000 on the microfilm seemed to me, and still seems like, a good deal, even though people don't like to use microfilm these days. It is still there, and these days it is all listed in the catalog too, so people can find it. In those days, of course, it was not in the card catalog. You had to go to a bibliography volume, which we had in reference. And in fact, we've still got those bibliography volumes around, but nobody looks at them.
Can you talk at all about special collections before you came, all the way back to the beginnings, or how it started?
Well, sure. I can talk a little. The first person we ever had who was designated as special collections librarian was, as I think I said earlier, Kathy Schaefer. At that point, this was only a part-time job. The reference librarians in those days each spent on the reference desk probably around 20 hours a week. We had multiple reference desks when we got to this present building, the Mansfield Library building. We opened the building with only three floors, levels one to the two below ground, and level three. Levels four and five were totally unfinished. And we started out with an information desk, which was staffed a lot of the time by professional librarians. And downstairs, on levels one and two, were all the books, magazines in the building. And each of those had a reference desk. Level one was for documents and social sciences, if I recall correctly, and level two for the humanities and sciences. And they were pretty full, too. The original plan had been that we would have four reference desks when we finally occupied the entire building. And the original plan had been postulated on the assumption, which had probably actually been told to our then Dean of Library Services, that we would have like 15 or so reference librarians. And if we'd had 15 or 16 reference librarians, why, we could have manned four desks, mm-hmm. even with the heavy schedules that they maintained in those days. We weren't open as many hours then as we are now either. We probably only open about 80 hours a week. Mm-hmm. So it could have been done. But the problem was we didn't have the reference librarians. Instead, by the time we were moving in, the enrollment had stabilized and begun to shrink. And it was quite apparent when we went upstairs that we would not have anywhere near enough librarians to cover four reference desks. So in one of the earliest faculty meetings that we had, we concluded that the only sensible thing to do was to have one reference desk near the front door, and have the, all the reference books up on level one. On level three, the front door level. The reference books had been split between levels one and two, of course, and the theory had been that the space, which was sitting there empty, where reference books are housed today in late 2006 to the right of the front doors as you come in, that space had been planned to be used as a reading room. Our then director of technical services had the idea that there should be a room for pleasure reading for people, and it might have been a nice idea, but we never really built it. Instead, as I say, we moved the reference in there and had one reference desk, and Kathy Schaefer spent a lot of her time on that, and so basically she did that, and she did some ordering. But most of the things that were in special collections had just sort of drifted in over the years. There wasn't any serious attempt to buy things for special collections because there wasn't any money to do it. I believe Janice Pacino may have been the first one who actually had any money to buy anything for special collections, because I don't remember if Kathy did. She might have. In those days, the library was run on a quite different basis than it is now. For one thing, up until the mid-70s, there were no library faculty meetings at all. We had this was in the days of Dean Thompson. And Dean Thompson was an old-school head librarian. He had him in the head office and the director of public services and the director of technical services and one secretary and maybe one student assistant, and they ran the library. Mm. There wasn't thought to be any real need to have things like faculty meetings. It's interesting that at that point we did have a library staff association, which had regular meetings, and people got to gather, not just faculty members, but staff members. People got together fairly regularly and did things like the maintenance of the staff lounge and so on. And paid more attention to that sort of thing than they do now. Eventually there were people who complained about this. I was not one of them. I never cared that much. And we did start having real faculty meetings and also real staff meetings with the we continued to have whole staff meetings and even some meetings of the dean with the people who work here who aren't faculty members. But getting back to the Kathy Schaefer and Janice Pacino, Kathy did not have that much time to do this full time. Janice was, as I say, only here for a year. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure if it was an entire year. So when I took over, nobody had been doing that much. There were, for example, many thousands of pamphlets which had just been there used to be a pamphlet file, but there hadn't been one for a while until I reinstated it. Mm-hmm. And nobody had done anything with the money from the Phillips collection and so on. Mm-hmm. So I did some of that stuff.
Books that that were originally before Kathy even placed in a separate location for special collections, was that just reference librarians? Did who sort of decided that those were useful? Were they the original library books? Did people just find old books?
It's not. People didn't certainly look for all the old books. I don't know. I know that a lot of things were pulled out by somebody. I don't really know who. In those days, technical services had very little to do with public services. There was a greater separation than there is now, in part because there weren't any faculty meetings in a lot of that period, and also because as in I think most academic libraries, the people in technical services didn't know that much about what the people in public services were doing, and vice versa. We were not at that point doing the sort of faculty evaluation that we do today, where you prepare elaborate documentation every year and all the faculty read it. That was not being done during the time period I've been talking about. It wasn't that people were really, really unfriendly. You have the case, for example, of Dale, who was the archivist, and there, of course, Dale was special because he didn't think of himself as being a librarian at all. But you have him marrying Kobe, who was in technical services. But everybody knew everybody's name, but we didn't really know much about what each other did.
You mentioned archives. So archives, can you speak at all about early days of the archives?
Well, the person who needs to speak about the early days of the archives is Dale Johnston, because he started the archives, and you ought to get him in and talk to you. So I can tell you that archives was started as a result of an initiative by K. Ross Toole, which is why this is named the K. Ross Toole Archives today. And I can tell you that Dale Johnston was the first archivist, succeeded by Jody Allison Bunnell, succeeded by the present archivist just a couple of years ago. But you ought to get Dale to talk about this.
Well, let's talk about the collections themselves. Can you think offhand of one, multiple items that when you first started, they struck you as the most interesting, most valuable, most... Just what did you sort of notice when you took over the collections?
Well, when I took over, of course, I didn't really... This is one of those cases where I basically learned on the job. I've always been interested in books. I've always done a lot of reading. I got a chance to see a lot of books. And one way that some books got into special collections when I was a cataloger was that I, or anybody else who spotted something that they thought should be locked up, just locked it up and put it in special collections. And we would lock it up for a variety of reasons. There was one book I remember very early on. It came in and we looked at it. This is like early 1970. We looked at it and said, oh no, we've got to lock this up. It was because it cost us $75.
Do you remember what the book was?
No, I haven't a clue. It was something in the, I think it was something in the sciences, and I don't think it's locked up anymore. Though it might be. I don't have a clue what it was. But at that point, an ordinary novel cost about $4.95. An ordinary textbook cost maybe $10 or $12. And $75 for a not particularly large book was just an incredible price. So we locked them up for that reason. And we locked things up that were tiny. And we locked things up that were likely to get swiped for any reason. If somebody spotted something that they thought was valuable, and that could include something, of course, that was in the stacks, why they would just say, why don't we lock this up? And I believe that we didn't do this all that often, and I think that a lot of things were locked up. Somebody, before I got here, and I honestly don't know who, if it was Janice or Kathy Schaefer, because I don't recognize the handwriting, but somebody pulled a bunch of the books out of the regular special the regular M collection stacks and locked them up in M special collections. Mm-hmm. The Phillips collection, of course, had been set up as a special collection. There were plenty of other things that were in special collections, but nowhere near as many as there are today. Mm. Because we weren't buying anything for special collections in those days. Specifically, or almost nothing. We had a bunch of old Montana items that, as I say, had been moved from the one collection to the other. And over the years, remember, by the time I took over, the library was already 90 years old, mm-hmm. almost. Let's see. Yeah, 90 years old, over 90 years old. So over the years, things had sort of filtered there. But there was never, I think I was the first one ever to come out with a finding aid which described the nature of special collections. What is in special collections? You've got later versions of that. If you go through all the stuff I'm speaking to Jordan now. If Jordan goes through all the stuff I left him, why, there's even some earlier versions of that finding aid dating back to some very early ones.
Are there particular books you remember just enjoying, particular titles, or?
Particular titles that I enjoyed that were there when I arrived. It's hard for me to remember what all was there when I arrived and what's come since. One thing that had come was the Capra Jones books. Those had been given in the early 80s before I came to Special Collections, and those, of course, included a lot of our Arthur Rackham books, and there were also Special Collections of Faulkner and Maurice Sendak's illustrations and Rockwell Kent's illustrations. Plus a bunch of other things. Those were some of the nicest books that we had in the humanities. I remember we also had, by that time, the Mansfield books. We had most of the Mansfield books by that time because he, of course, took over as ambassador to Japan in 1976. '77. I'm sorry. After he left the Senate in 1976, and so we'd been getting those Mansfield books and adding them to special collections. Lots and lots of lovely Japanese art books for some time. Before the Mansfield collection arrived and the I'm not sure how many books there really were in special collections. It would have been several bookcases full, surely, 30, 40 feet of shelving probably, but I don't know. It wasn't nearly as many as there were afterwards. Because even the Mansfield books made up a lot of the edition, probably. There must be at least 30 or 40 feet of them. And even just the gift from the Capra Jones gift must have been 20 feet or more, maybe 30 feet. I don't know. A lot of books.
Well, during the time that you were running special collections, what do you think are the most important, interesting?
Well, the most important books that we've added since I took over, I mentioned, of course, the one really important edition that I did earlier of the microfilm, but when we get to real books, the most important would be the things that we've added in Montana history, particularly relating to Lewis and Clark. When I arrived, we had already the Patrick Gass's journal that we've got now, and we had the partial set of the, it's the second or third British edition of Lewis and Clark, but of course I added the first edition of Lewis and Clark and the other things on early Western exploration. I added them with the Steele Rees gift, and I added a lot of other things over the years that cost less than that. The biggest, the most important additions to special collections have come through gift money, because we have never had more than a few thousand dollars a year, not enough to buy even one major book. So the only times when we have been able to get major books in the $10,000, $15,000 range were if we A, already had them, or B, we got gift money. There were some of those that we already had, but when I took over, I can't say that I really even, I scarcely knew about them. They weren't worth as much then, of course, as they are now either, a lot of them. Things like the Captain Cook's voyages. That's worth a lot of money now, and when I took over, it might have been worth a couple of thousand dollars. There were things we didn't get, too. One thing that I uncovered before I became Special Collections Librarian, I discovered that there was, back in that cage I was telling you about, this happened actually when we were cataloging all those leftover books when we had no money for acquisitions. I discovered a copy, a grungy, nasty copy, of the second folio Audubon Birds of America. Mm-hmm. The second folio is the chromolith version. And we had been keeping it around. It was awfully grungy. I think the reason that they hadn't broken it up was because it seemed like too much trouble. But I did some checking, and at that point, that book was worth $7,000, probably. Mm-hmm. Or at least I found a copy that was worth $7,000. Maybe this one wasn't worth quite that. But nobody else had realized it was worth anything at all. And I brought that to the attention of Dean Thompson. We were, as I say, real short of money at that point, and we sold that. And that's why we don't have an Audubon folio here. We had the text volumes that went with it, too. The quarto text volumes. It's not as nice as the earlier one, because the chromolithography that they used to print from the original plates does not give as pretty a result. The colors are gaudier. Yeah. But it's a shame we don't have it anymore, but we were real short of money then. And I didn't have any. I was just a cataloger. I didn't have anything to do with whether we kept something like that or not. I was doing my duty by explaining to people that we had this and it was worth a lot of money. What should we do with it? Because I was not Special Collections Librarian, and I wasn't going to be for, I don't know how many years, 10 years maybe.
Well, as far as policies, just sort of general changes to special collections, what do you think the biggest changes are? What do you feel most proud of as far as...
What I am most proud of, actually perhaps the thing I'm most proud of in my whole career here, is that it's because of me that we have a mist type sprinkler system in this part of the building, the Archive Special Collections area, mm-hmm. instead of the showerhead type system that we have over the entire building. Actually, I suspect I may be responsible for the fact that there's a sprinkler system in here at all. The then dean, Karen Hatcher, asked me one day, "How much is our collection worth?" She asked me because I was the special collections librarian, because I was supposed to know that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I thought a little, and I said, well, average book replacement costs nationwide something like $30, and we've got about 1 million volumes here. So the actual replacement cost of everything in the building, when you add in cataloging too, which you would have to, must be somewhere between $30 and $50 million. And then I didn't hear anything more for a year or 18 months. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, in the governor's budget, 1 year, in the governor's spending budget, there was this line that moved something that had been a campus priority about 20th on the long-range building program for this campus, which meant, of course, that it was never going to happen, mm-hmm. up to, I think, second or third, we could look it up if you're curious enough, in the whole long-range building program for the state of Montana. One line, $550,000, sprinkle library. And if that wasn't because somebody had suddenly noticed that, no, we don't have sprinklers, and yes, it would cost a ton of money if the library ever burned down, I don't know why. I don't know that I did this, but I think I might have. Well, sprinkling the library actually made for a bunch of changes. One thing that it made for was that those of us in archives and special collections on level one of the building no longer wanted to be on level one of the building, because should there ever be a major release of water, it's all going to wind up on level one after a while. Actually, thinking about it now and knowing more about sprinklers than I did then, I suspect that a fire hose might have wound up causing more release of water than a sprinkler fire any place is likely to anyway. Mm-hmm. But it reminded us, too. We were more worried then. You tend to worry more about a sprinkler system going in before it goes in than after, if there aren't any problems. Mm-hmm. But one thing that did bother me, at least, was the notion that archives and special collections would be subject to a regular sprinkler system, which is essentially little shower heads all over the ceiling. Mm-hmm. If one of those little shower heads goes off right over the most valuable books in the collection, it can trash them. So instead, since it's no longer feasible to use the gas type sprinkler suppression or fire suppression systems, mist was a logical alternative. I should explain for the benefit of people who are not into this sort of thing that a lot of libraries used to have halon systems and that spray out gas that keeps the oxygen away and keeps the fire from burning up your rare books. These cost about as much as sprinkler systems, and the gas that is released is dangerous to greenhouse gases. And therefore, those are no longer in use. any place that people have been able to get the special collections librarians to give them up. Jordan might know better than I do, have some better sense than I do, how many gas-type systems there are still out there. I know there are some.
I know that there are quite a few that are still grandfathered in.
Yeah, but right. Nobody's building any.
Yeah, more restricted to vaults.
Yeah. Yeah, in a vault, of course, it's not as big a problem because it doesn't get out as much, at least not until you open the door. But the vault is smaller.
They kill fewer people if they go on. Another problem,
yeah.
Talon.
Yeah, that's the other problem, is, as Jordan points out. If there are people in the stacks, and the halon goes off, it gets rid of all the oxygen, which kills all the fire and kills any human beings or other creatures who might be in there. Whereas what we've got is a mist system, which lets out essentially a thick fog in Special Collections and the Montana room and the workroom back here, and this office of Jordan's that I'm in. We'll just make it foggy in here, and the fog is dense enough that it does put out the fire, but it, in a climate like this, just evaporates and doesn't do much of any harm. I would certainly anticipate, and we've never had a release, but I don't anticipate that it's going to hurt much of anything at all. It's not good for the books to suddenly get moist and then dry out again, but it's not nearly as bad for them as burning up. Not nearly. And I got, I mentioned that this was a possibility to people. I got the campus architect on our side. I got the campus engineer on our side. I talked to the people from the construction company and the people who were designing this for us. And because the architect and the engineer were on our side, and I talked to these other people, we were able to get a mist system in a small portion of the library. I wish we had a mist system in the entire library. The other thing I wish we had, and I'll mention this one on the tape and hope that it doesn't jinx us, I hope that the bracing for earthquakes that we have done is satisfactory. That was another thing that I pushed for all the time I was here. And I did get them to spend money on that. It's not ceiling bracing, however. It's floor bracing. And I hope that it keeps the stacks from going over when there is an earthquake here. Not if, but when. There will be an earthquake here. A major earthquake sometime, and very likely, the world being as it is, this library will still be full of books and book stacks when that happens. And if anyone is still using those books in book stacks at that time, which I suspect some people will be, although probably not as many as today, and there is an earthquake, and it happens during the 12 hours or so a day during the school year when there is are a significant number of people here, if the book stacks go over, people will die unpleasantly. So I hope the bracing works. I did my very best, and I did finally, I pushed hard enough on that one that they did spend some money on bracing. What else am I proud of? I'm proud of getting the books on Montana and the exploration of the West that we got in the Steele Reese grant that I applied for, and that we also got because we were getting books. I did a lot more of this sort of thing under our most recent dean, not our present dean, but our most recent dean, Frank D'Andrea, than I did under the other deans. A lot of deans take the attitude, oh, there's a special collections, isn't that nice? Some of them don't quite understand what the difference between a special collections librarian and an archivist is. A lot of them just sort of ignore the special collections and the archives too, probably, unless something strange comes up. But Dean D'Andrea believed in this as a way of getting other gifts for the library and of getting people impressed about the library. If you get those gifts there, then you can spend lots of other money on automation, was his attitude, I believe. So we wound up spending not too much money, but getting a lot of gifts on this and spending some money of the universities. I don't think your present dean is as interested.
I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. Okay. How often does she come upstairs?
Makes her way up when she can, I believe.
Okay. We can edit some of this out. That's another advantage of digital.
Well, sort of final thoughts. Anything else you'd sort of want to get on the record? Want to say about special collections?
About special collections.
Library generally, or...
Yeah, well, I haven't talked about the library generally. I could give you all sorts of dirt on past deans and... I did a little of that already. The library in general, I would say that these days things are very different than when I came. We had faculty rank and status when I arrived here, but it didn't mean much. And the truth is that it didn't mean as much probably to the faculty as a whole as it does now. There was a tendency in the library in the years before I got here, there were some people who I suspect, we can't give you a raise this year, so we'll make you a faculty member of the library instead of just a staff member. Mm-hmm. When I arrived, there were several people who were in senior positions in the library, but were listed as librarians, but were not library school graduates. Mm. And of course, there were other people who were library school graduates, but in those days, it had been a bachelor's degree. Because the master's degree for librarianship didn't come in until after the Second World War. And we still had Mrs. DeLand and Mrs. Midget, who were the people in charge of cataloging when I arrived, had both... Mrs. DeLand was just retiring, and she had been the head of cataloging for... I don't know how long before that, 20 years, which would have been back in the 40s.
Well, thank you for agreeing to be interviewed today. Enjoyed it.
And thank you for having me.
My pleasure, absolutely.